I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is cantor Hillel Tagay, discussing contemporary Jewish music and his new CD, Judeo. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's been a stupendously hot week here in southern Arizona where I live, with temperatures rising above 100 degrees at the start of June, and every day since then reaching the century mark. It is, of course, a dry heat, but so's the inside of a pizza oven, and when it cracks 105 degrees, frankly, it's just hot. There's a stereotype that hell is as hot as fire. If so, hell is likely a couple of degrees cooler than Tucson has been this past week, and it's going to be that way for the next few weeks. It's hot. There's no dressing that up. Perhaps it's actually an excuse to undress. And officially, summer doesn't even start until this coming week. Well, official beginning this coming Thursday or not, summer, hot or otherwise, is a good time to unwind and shift gears, to move from the way we've been doing things to a slower, more contemplative period. For most of us, our regular life is a little quieter in the summer, less filled with tasks and errands and projects and events. It's a time for vacations, for shorter work days, more time with family and friends. A time to celebrate life at a slower pace, to catch our breath, think about ways in which we might live better, more meaningful, healthier, happier lives. One way to change things up in the summer is to take the time to dedicate ourselves to taking time every week, even in these slower, hotter days, to celebrate the Sabbath. Done regularly and properly, Shabbat is a kind of mini summer vacation weekly, a time to appreciate what we have, to show gratitude for the gifts we're given by God. It's good time to spend with family and friends, to plan for a slower-paced Friday night dinner, a relaxing day in which we don't spend most of it, or maybe any of it, glued to our computer screens and iPhones. It's a day to pray and study, to share real live quality time with those people we care most about, not Facebook time with virtual friends, real ones. A good lesson for any season. Why not try it yourself this coming Friday and Saturday? Summer's also the season when we send our kids off to summer camp and actually have time for ourselves at home. Quite a novel concept for a lot of us. It would be a tragedy if for some reason this year we failed to play the ultimate classic of summer camp, the late great Alan Sherman's Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. Here it is.
Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey, he developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner, he got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators. And the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy, they're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fada, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mada, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball, gee, that's better. Mada Fada, kindly disregard this letter.
Classic summer camp shtick from the magnificent Alan Sherman. Our guest this morning creates a very different kind of Jewish music. It includes a rich array of influences from folk music to chazanut to world music. Here's his take on Hinei Matov, how good it is and how pleasant for us to be here together in unity. Hillel Tigay, setting one of the great psalms. That was Hillel Tigay's Hinei Matov. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, we'll meet him, cantor Hillel Tigay, cantor of the innovative synagogue Ikar in Los Angeles, creator of a new CD of interesting and refreshing Jewish music called Judeo. Find out where his musical influences lie and what's wrong with contemporary Jewish music and how he would fix it when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Craig difference at Jim Craig Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style. It looks absolutely great. And it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Hillel Tigay. His new album is called Judeo. It's a really beautiful and interesting mix of traditional Jewish text, themes, and somewhere between rock and pop and world music. Welcome, good morning.
Good morning, thank you for having me.
In coming up with this album, Judeo, you mix a lot of different genres, I would say. What's your principal influence?
I guess it might seem like a mix to people on first blush, but to me it's just sort of a total amalgam of who I am as a musician. I guess I've run the gamut from pop music and Beatles and Beach Boys and that kind of stuff when I was a kid first learning guitar, then moving into classical music and Spanish guitar, and then even more esoteric stuff like Renaissance lute music, and then I got into more progressive pop music, British pop and stuff like Peter Gabriel, and then back around into world music and Jewish music, Turkish music, Ottoman Arabic music, Persian music, and a strong underpinning has been Jewish music, because ever since a kid, my parents played a lot of that around the home, and I spent years in Israel hearing that stuff, both on the radio and also just walking through the streets in the shuk, hearing a lot of really exotic Eastern stuff. So it's all in a big melting pot and stirred around, and that's Judeo.
You know, it's fascinating. Yeah, I don't know why anybody would think that sounds like a mix.
Well, the truth is, in the past, I had thought, I used to do pop music, and I used to think heavily about the genre and the audience I was trying to reach, and, you know, you're sort of right in that formula, but the gentleman that executive produced this record with me, who's a veteran and kind of legendary music biz guy, told me that this should just be about my totally doing, you know, what I love and being myself and not trying to pander to doing something that's religious or on the other hand, pop, but just, you know, write totally from the heart. So I really wasn't consciously trying to do any genre. You know, I think that this, it's not like there's some jugular vein of you know, commercial music like this. So that's, you know, that would have been chasing my tail, I think.
I think it's pretty much always true that when you try to make the best music you can make, the stuff you like the best, it works. And when you try to imitate another genre, it doesn't.
Yeah, I hope you're right. That's what I tried to do.
You know, Jewish music today is carving in some new directions, and we'll talk much more about it later. But do you feel sort of a gradually increasing level of freedom in what you can do musically?
Well, I do, and that's largely because I've been serving as the musical director in Chazan at a very progressive temple out here in Los Angeles called Ikar. And the idea was to try to do something that would reinvent and reinvigorate synagogue life and animate it with something that would, while on the one hand feel really traditional and rooted, also do something that was, that felt like it was happening now, and that would really resonate with younger people and certain hipper people and people who are more integrated into secular life, I would say. And so that was from day one what we were trying to do there. That's the reason I took the job there. It wasn't because somebody said, here's what prayer service sounds like, imitate it. It was because we wanted to ask the question, what would make a prayer service beautiful and better? So when you're thinking about how to build and be creative and attract people, I think you open up the door to do things that are new. So at this point, I guess I'm kind of used to it. But, you know, traditionally in synagogues, the question that people ask musically is, what is the correct way, not what is the inspiring or beautiful way?
We will talk much more and continue to try to find what the most inspirational way to do Jewish music when we come back with Hillel Tagain a little bit on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. Our guest this morning, Cantor Hillel Tagay, has his own approach to creating contemporary Jewish music, at time using traditional texts as anthems. This is his version of Psalm 150, the greatly musical final text of the Book of Psalms, Hallelujah, from his new CD, Judeo. Personal note now. Last week, we suffered a great loss in our own Jewish community when Anna Greenberg, a 28-year-old young woman, lost a two-year-long battle to cancer. Anna was the bravest person I ever knew, I think. She never admitted defeat, never gave in to the frustration and intense pain she experienced. She survived 10 operations, many, many other treatments and procedures, and always lived fully and fiercely. Her hero was the actress Bette Midler, and when Midler heard about Anna's illness, she invited Anna out to Los Angeles for a premiere of her comedy with Billy Crystal called Parental Guidance, funny movie, a few months ago. Anna met her. In the last week of her life, Bette Midler called Anna on the phone and had a long discussion with her, and then at Anna's request sang the beautiful song Wind Beneath My Wings from the movie Beaches. You could hear Bette Midler crying as she sang it. It was an unbelievably touching moment. Anna was extraordinary, not least because she and her family thought that what she was doing was not extraordinary or even courageous at all. They just thought it was the right way to live. Anna even managed to set her phone to text her father a couple of days after she died, saying that, "I'm in my new home and I'm fine." Amazing. I don't really know how to explain what it was that made Anna Greenberg so special. Perhaps it was the lack of pretense, the insistence that nobody pity her, the courage to show up, with or without a wig, to joke about her many procedures and surgeries, her failing eyesight, the instantaneous warmth and openness she extended automatically to everybody. Maybe it was the tragic circumstance she refused to see as tragedy. Maybe it was simply that when you visited Anna in the hospital or at home or at one of the many community events she continued to attend, and you thought you were going to cheer her up, she was the one who cheered you up. I had the privilege of leading a healing service for back at Hanukkah last December. We had a number of rabbis participate and family members, and then Anna showed up too for her own healing service. I don't know if that service helped Anna, but it helped a lot of us feel that at least we were doing something for her because her courage did so much for all of us. She was great, and she lives on in so many of our memories.
It must have been cold there in my shadow to never have sunlight on your face. You were content to let me shine, that's your way. You always walked
L'chile shalom, Anna. Go now in peace, but don't really go. Stay with us and help us to have some of your remarkable courage. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So summer is about to start officially, and summer in Israel, the Kayetz, is a very special time. Most American Jews who have been to Israel have gone in the summer. Let's talk about summer in Israel for Israelis.
Well, summer is my favorite. I need to be honest. You wake up in the morning when you're a kid. My memories are probably when I was a teenager, so forgive me. When you're an adult, it's not the same because you wake up in the morning and go to work. But when you're a teenager and there is summer vacation, oh, I wish we had summer vacation as adults, right?
Right.
You wake up, you go with your friends to the beach, go to the ocean, swim, get a fresh cold watermelon, cut it, eat it on the beach, go and have an ice cream and all that. It's fun. And then you go back home, wash a bit, go out to the streets to, in my case, in Haifa, Merkaz HaKarmel, the Carmel Center with all the coffee shops. And usually at the summer, the City Hall will prepare a lot of shows and festivals.
Music
and
music, performances.
Live performances, live marketplaces and stuff like that. So you hang out until late hours of the night, go to parties, and it's crazy time, you know. As a teenager, you party until the middle of the night, sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning, go back home, get some few hours of sleep, and wake up, go back to the beach. You know, that's summer. Oh, how I miss that summer.
I'm jealous already. You know, it's funny. Most of us, as I said, American Jews who travel to Israel, we go in the summer, and we think it's like that all the time. But one thing about Israel people don't realize is, you know, wonderful coastline, great beaches from really, you know, the south, Ashdod, all the way up, and of course down in Eilat too. But Haifa is a very underrated place.
Oh, Haifa has the best shoreline in Israel. I love Haifa very much. And during summertime, Haifa is the best because that's the best time to tour the Bahá'í Gardens in Haifa. That's also a great time to visit the different museums along Haifa. There are amazing museums in Haifa. Of course, Saturday, Shabbat, if you go to the beach, it will be packed. you can't move a nail on the beach on Saturday. But if you're on a trip to Israel and you can go to the beach, not over the weekend.
And by the way, Sunday is not really a weekend in Israel, so that's a good day to go to the beach.
Well, of course, Sunday is Yom Rishon, the first day of the week. That's right. one of the things that I've been trying to explain to Americans, and some reason they don't seem to get it. It's Rishon, Sheni, Shlishi, Revi'i, Chamishi, Shishi, Shabbat. So Rishon, Sunday, is the first day of the week. It's not part of the weekend.
Right. For those of us who don't have summer vacation, it's a work day in Israel.
Yeah, so I need to go to the beach now after all this talk, and I want to eat some watermelon.
Watermelon on the beach, and then a little glida afterwards.
Exactly.
Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about Turkey, which has gone into paroxysms of what looks kind of like revolution against the Islamist government, against the Prime Minister Erdogan. You know, what's always been so fascinating about Turkey, here it is, you know, kind of the crossroads of Europe and Asia and the Middle East, strongly associated with the Ottoman Empire, which was Islamic, and of course, since Kemal Atatürk, a secular republic instead, and kind of a bulwark of secular values, no matter the fact that the vast majority of his population is Muslim. They've respected minority rights. This has all been questioned since the advent of the Islamic leadership there, Islamist leadership. Anyway, let's talk about sort of the dynamics going on within the country.
Right. Well, there are some paradoxes. I mean, first of all, modern Turkey has been sufficiently secularist and tolerant that minorities such as Jews and Armenians, who are both ethnic minorities and religious minorities, have not left in large numbers. They haven't flooded out. There's still a very important, particularly in Istanbul, Jewish community, Armenian community, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Greeks are another story. I mean, the Greek Orthodox community in Istanbul is a tiny shadow of its former self. But that was because of a series of events that began in the 20s and recurred at least through the 1950s. And if there is any discrimination at all, it's against the old rulers of Constantinople, because after all, who ruled over Constantinople for more than 1,000 years? It was the Greek Orthodox establishment. That's
Empire.
Where their Vatican was, their Pope was, et cetera, et cetera. Once the Ottomans conquered the city in 1453, they arrogated unto themselves the right for the Ottoman Sultan, the emperor, to also be the caliph, which had previously been unrelated to a state.
Both secular and religious authority in one figure.
Right, and the caliphate was officially abolished when Turkey was replaced by a secular republic, and there is no official caliph for Islam today. But that being said, I think it's not fair to describe Turkey as an Islamist country, or even the government as an Islamist government, because while it's true that the biggest party in parliament has Islamist overtones, there are plenty of secularists and true Kemalists, people who are true to the legacy of Atatürk, in government. And this Islamist party can't do anything by itself. The protests really boil down to the fact that the current prime minister and some of his staunch allies, among whom are mayors of key cities like Istanbul, are Islamists, and they are pushing an agenda either locally or nationally which doesn't sit well with many people. Obviously, there's enough people to reelect this party to be the majority party in parliament. But that doesn't mean, I mean, parliamentary systems don't work the same way our system does. It's not two parties, there's a majority and a minority. They rule by coalition, exactly like in Israel. So Turkish politics is going to be very interesting to watch in the coming days. How Erdogan re-enters the scene, if he modifies or withdraws any of his earlier pronouncements, particularly in the wake of his deputy prime minister's announcements, which totally contradicted his own. I mean, this is, Turks don't like open splits and open disagreements. So this is going to be quite a fascinating and important process to watch.
Very important. And an important country, maybe never more so, with Syria in the middle of a civil war. Turkey has been at times a close ally of Israel, then under Erdogan pushed very far away. Now maybe a little bit of a rapprochement there. It's a very interesting time. We'll talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. A gabbai, the rabbi's assistant at the synagogue, approaches a guest in the shul and says to him, "I want to give you an aliyah to call you up to the Torah. Here we do it in Hebrew, so what's your Hebrew name?" "It's Rivka Bas Tzvi," the man says. "Rebecca, the daughter of Tzvi." "No," says the gabbai, "I need your name, not your wife's name." But the guy says, "It really is Rivka Bas Tzvi, Rebecca, the daughter of Tzvi." "I'm confused," says the gabbai. "How can that be your name?" And the man answers, "I'm having some major financial problems now, and everything, and I mean everything, has been put in my wife's name." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week we read the Torah portion of Balak in the book of Numbers, which includes some of the best words an outsider ever delivered about our people. In the portion, one of just two in the whole Torah named after a non-Jew, 40 years of wandering have passed. The Israelites have finally arrived on the borders of the land of Canaan. They're about to move in, and they seem unstoppable to their opponents. Balak, the king of Moab, comes up with a novel plan. He will hire Balaam, a pagan sorcerer, to curse the Israelites, which will destroy their chances for defeating his own army and entering his land. But the scheme doesn't work. Balaam may be a polytheistic prophet, but he is also an honest man who conveys only what God permits him to say. After consulting the Almighty, Balaam agrees to do the deed, but only if God allows him to do so. And so we are given the intriguing spectacle of Balaam the sorcerer three times trying to curse the people of Israel, only to find that the words that come out of his mouth are not curses but blessings. The last of these orations is a text that has become the prayer we use whenever we enter a synagogue. Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov, how good are your tents, Jacob, your homes, Israel. Somehow the best laid plans of Israel's enemies go awry, transformed by the hand of God. Without being too deterministic, we know that in recent decades many nations and organizations have planned the destruction of our people and of our country, Israel. Although their efforts have injured us, ultimately we have triumphed. Perhaps more importantly, the personal message of this portion of Balak is a subtle one. Usually the way it works in life is that we intend to bring blessing, but bring tzoras, trouble instead. But if we rely on God's help and inspiration, we'll find that even our less than nobly motivated actions may bring blessing in the place of curses. It's all a matter of remembering the true source for inspiration and creativity, and therefore of blessing, which is God. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Cantor Hillel Tagay, will explore what makes music Jewish and what Jewish music should sound like in 2013 when we come back in a few moments.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu kicked off a two-day visit to Poland with a stern warning about a potential Holocaust from Iran. But his message was overshadowed by a diplomatic fiasco in which Netanyahu actually backtracked on an official joint statement from the Polish and Israeli governments. The statement, which was to be issued at the conclusion of the summit between the top ministers of Israel and Poland in Warsaw, recognized the Palestinians' right to a state and called unilateral steps by either party counterproductive to achieving a sustainable, lasting peace. Ah, but Netanyahu distanced himself from his own statement, that is the one released by his own office, claiming that it was issued by junior staff at the National Security Council of Israel with the agreement of Poland before the prime minister or the council director, Yaakov Amidror, had even read it. Netanyahu and Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk were supposed to read the statement on behalf of their governments at the conclusion of the summit. Although non-binding, the statement is considered a written official understanding between the two countries. Its tone on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process was moderate, but it included some controversial points. Both governments agree on the urgent need for progress towards a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through direct negotiations between the parties without preconditions. The Israeli-Polish statement also said the Palestinian right to a state should never be in doubt, expressed support for a just and lasting solution, allowing for the self-determination of the Jewish and Palestinian nations living side by side in peace and security. Ken O'Hara. Officials of Netanyahu's own bureau tried to minimize the joint statement's importance, saying it was only a protocol document that did not represent the Israeli government's position. It is not the Israeli government's position, not because the government takes the opposite position, but simply because the government has no official position on the Palestinian subject. Prime Minister Netanyahu's position is that he supports the establishment of a demilitarized Palestinian state that will recognize the Jewish state with appropriate security arrangements. That sounds kind of like preconditions. Anyway, after distancing himself from the statement, Netanyahu clarified to his Polish hosts that his own government is willing to resume talks with the Palestinians without preconditions, and that it's high time both sides stopped insisting on preconditions. Wow. Apparently, the trouble all began because the Israeli Foreign Ministry's office workers are on strike, and the Prime Minister's office had to handle all the details of the trip by itself. Very hard, apparently. Kind of a mess. In happier news, what might be the largest purchase of an Israeli startup in history took place when Google confirmed its acquisition of the Israeli navigation company Waze last week on Google's official blog. Google Vice President Brian McClendon did not indicate the price Google paid for Waze, although reports put the figure at $1.1 billion. McClendon said the product development team at Waze, a free downloadable navigation app with nearly 50 million subscribers, will remain in Israel and operate separately for now. Talks between Waze and the social networking site Facebook reportedly broke down over Waze's insistence that the company's managers and employees remain in their Israeli headquarters in Renana rather than relocating to Menlo Park. McClendon said his company is excited about the prospect of enhancing Google Maps with some of the traffic update features provided by Waze, and enhancing Waze with Google's search capacities. Waze CEO Noam Bardeen confirmed the purchase, writing on his company's blog that Google co-founder Larry Page, McClendon, and Google's Maps staff are all partners in our vision to serve global mapping updated in real time by communities and those interested in helping us develop. Well, mazel tov to Waze. Now we can be sure that our Google Maps app will take us wherever we want to go, including Israel. A new TV show, a sort of distressing reality show on the Bravo cable network, is out, and it's called Princesses of Long Island. I kid you not. Besides the obvious facts about the show, like every single reality show I've ever seen, it's incredibly boring, filled with contrived situations and generally irritating. This particular offering is an ode to awful stereotypes of East Coast Jewish young women. The stars, if you can call them that, are materialistic, superficial, heavily accented Long Island Jewish women, you know, Long Island, the ones you hear about in bad jokes, obsessed with clothing and appearance and finding a rich husband, or at least as they're portrayed in the show. And the show has the potential to set back the perception of Jewish women, oh, a few decades, if not centuries. Ugh. The good news is that it's already been called the worst reality TV show ever. Now, that's hard to believe. I mean, how do you evaluate the worst dreck in a collection of it? And it will probably be canceled soon. But it does make you wonder how it could even be created in this year of 2013. And the person recognized as the oldest Jew in the world died this week. New York-born Evelyn Kozak, 113 years old, known for her love of Scrabble and literature, died after suffering a heart attack last week. She was buried in Queens. Ms. Kozak, a former valedictorian at her grammar school in Brooklyn a really long time ago, attributed her longevity to her healthy lifestyle. A mother of five, she outlived two of her children and two husbands, survived two strokes and the Spanish flu. Evelyn Kozak had 10 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. This super centenarian, an ardent Zionist and practicing Jew, was the seventh oldest person in the world when she died. The oldest person in the world, Jiromiyan Kimura of Japan, also died last week, aged 116. Anyway, 3 years ago, in honor of her 110th birthday, Evelyn Kozak Day was declared in Pittsburgh, where she lived. May her memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Hillel Tagay. His new album is called Judeo. It is a really beautiful, interesting, contemporary, I don't want to call it a mix, I made the mistake of doing that earlier, expression of Jewish prayer and an exploration also, at least in the liner notes, of the way that prayer was done musically in the days of the temple in Jerusalem. Welcome back, Hillel.
Thank you. You by the way, I'm not too Jewish. I'm just Jewish enough, I believe.
There you go. Exactly. We like to have that discussion with people. You know, what does it mean to be too Jewish? In looking and listening to your music, you do use a variety of different instruments. Of course, the temple in Jerusalem was a very musical place. Psalm 150 has all kinds, you know, really a whole instrumental family. You said you did some research with your dad, who I think was on Two Jewish once before, the outstanding biblical scholar. Tell us what you found when you started to do that research.
It was really very interesting to me. I mean, apart from the basic facts one could learn about what kinds of instruments were played and who did what, something that interested me a lot was that this music wasn't really performed or done in front of an audience. It was the Levites and the priests basically accompanying sacrifice, and I suppose you could say they were putting on this prayer service in front of God, not an audience, though there were some Israelites who would walk through, you know, doing their sacrifices. This was not the way music is done today, which is in front of a congregation. So this made me start to think of the music and the prayer as sort of like a spiritual offering in the same manner, I suppose, as people would bring the best of their produce and animals to the temple to sacrifice to God, I sort of started to think of this as of you know, an expression of our deepest yearnings and prayers and our most hopefully beautiful musical expressions to put out there in front of God. So it's kind of a different way of thinking of it.
Yeah, sort of a korban, a musical korban, a musical sacrifice.
Yeah, that's exactly how I started to think of it.
You know, so often when we're leading services, I was a cantor before I became a rabbi, people think about it as a performance. Well, I mean, certainly there's have to be performance qualities in anything that you do in a service, but that's not the point. Do you find people understand that?
Well, that is something that I came to understand through the work I described earlier at ECAR. The idea, I think the biggest difference between places that are performative and the places that are not is that the former, you're trying to do something beautiful, but it's okay if people just sit back and listen. Whereas if you're doing something, I think, that's supposed to be non-performative, the main point is to try to engage people to pray on their own, meaning it becomes a backdrop, more of a soundtrack that will enhance their prayer experience. And so what I always try to do is pick rhythms and melodies that are going to engage people to sing, stomp, clap, and participate, because it should not be a spectator sport.
Are there times when you want people just to listen?
I think that there are certain times when I'm doing something as the leader that's more sophisticated and nuanced, and if people don't know it well, they're not going to be able to sing along and make something that enhances the meditative mood, and so it's better if they just listen. An example might be something on the High Holidays, like, you know, Kol Nidre, which is long and sophisticated, and something like that. It's okay, I think, if people, you know, close their eyes and are taken somewhere special. But I'd say the balance should always be the majority of the music should be that which engages and calls for participation. I've seen the difference. I've seen how people's hearts open up far more when they not only participate with their mouths, but also their bodies, which is the way people used to pray more. I mean, some people interpret the term machol, which is in Psalm 150 that you mentioned, as with, you know, ecstatic dance. And I think if you look at certain cultures back east, it's a big part of their prayer service, you know, moving forwards and backwards.
Yeah, dancing. Shuffling, I mean, and davening.
Right, and we have that, and of course in the Orthodox community, people still do that, but that's been sort of excised out of more polite American conservative and reform services, and it's a shame because when you get your whole body into it, it does bring your heart and your mind into it. And I used to be that guy who was awkward and embarrassed and thought it was, you know,
tacky,
sort of an anachronism to do that. But when you start to do it and ask other people to do it, it's just amazing how it makes the words resonate in a different way and the music resonate in a different way.
It impresses me, and maybe this is wrong, that one of an analogy for the difference between sort of traditional prayer traditional prayer, performative prayer, and participatory prayer is sort of the difference between classical music and going to a rock concert.
I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, in a classical concert, you know, it's a lot stiffer, and, you know, the job of the audience is to be very, very still and very, very quiet, and to clap during breaks in the movements, and then to clap more loudly when it's over, and they're never really sure when it's over. until the conductor gives that cue. But in a rock concert, of course, there are moments when the band asks the audience to sing along, and people are standing and clapping and shouting, and it's just part of the culture. And that's just how we do it today. I mean, classical music is a snapshot of what things were like in the past, but I think our generation, participation is the word of the day. And so we're just bringing that into the prayer service. I mean, the best pop and rock concerts I've been to are ones where you could say it was a religious experience, although the music is secular, like U2 and Peter Gabriel, you know, sometimes Bruce Springsteen for people. It's secular music.
Somewhere in the fifth hour of the Bruce Springsteen concert,
yeah,
something right. Religious happens.
That's right. So the idea with what I do is to try to give people sort of, I guess, a religious experience in that pop sense, but also the double entendre is it's, of course, religious music. So there's the rub.
It seems to me that a lot of contemporary American Jewish music, it's getting more interesting, but for a long time it was really just kind of, I don't know how to say this nicely, 60s and early 70s folk music played 30 or 35 years later. That's not what you do.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, that's funny that you notice that. I always used to, let's see if this analogy makes any sense. It's like when you watch a sitcom and they bring on a guy who's supposed to be a rock star, they always bring on a guy like who's wearing a leather jacket and sunglasses, which is sort of like the way a rock star looked 25 years ago. And that's what I think Jewish music has been. It's been, you know, hey, we're doing something contemporary for the kids that all you hipsters are going to like, but they're doing something that really feels very dated generally. So, you know, when you started off by saying this is something rock or pop, I mean, I suppose that's true, but it's more, you know, towards the world music side of that, or the art rock or the art pop. And hopefully it's something current and progressive, like what you would hear on National Public Radio rather than on, you know, one of those, you know,
golden oldies stations
that plays Motown.
Yeah.
When, you know, what you can produce in a studio is not necessarily the same thing you can produce in a live service that you're doing weekly. How do you make that transition?
Well, what I'm trying to do in both is capture a magical meditative vibe. And the nice thing about the CD is, at least in our congregation, when people hear that and then hear the more watered down, sparser version, they can sort of fill in the gaps in their brain in the service, because we don't use instruments on Shabbat. We just use voices, and we also use hand drums. But hopefully the idea is that the melodies and the rhythms are what's the most compelling thing, and everything else is just icing on the cake. And so you can still attain that vibe. But, you know, that's been a constant issue, the trying to bridge that gap between, you know, the big fleshed out sound you can do in the studio and the sparser thing that happens in a prayer service. And you've got to make adjustments. You know, you've got to try to, like I said, recreate the spiritual intensity and vibe, even if you're doing a very different arrangement. But, you know, I think it works a lot of the time.
Last question. Did you fund this project on Kickstarter
to a degree?
I didn't fund it that way. That was money that was raised towards the end of the recording project, which we've been using to market
to promote the CD.
So I had funding for the recording process.
Sure.
And needed extra money because... you know, if you want anybody to hear about your project, you can't just put it on iTunes and expect the world to love it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how many other Jewish projects have had that, but it's a great and innovative way to approach it. Hillel Tagay's CD is called Judeo. It's wonderful. Where's the best place? What's the website to go to?
Judeomusic.com, or you can go to the conventional places like iTunes and Amazon.
Thanks so much, Hillel. Really enjoyed it.
A pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the fascinating author and academic, Dr. Joy Layden, the transgender professor from Yeshiva University, whose story you must hear to believe. Our playout this morning comes from Hillel Tagay, of course, his Baruch HaMakom, Blessed is the Place, the Holy God. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of cool and peace.